This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Samantha Donovan. This Thursday, questions being raised about the cause of the Ukrainian airliner crash outside Tehran. The ex-boss of carmaker Nissan makes his first public appearance since fleeing Japan in mysterious circumstances. And the animals returning to a New South Wales zoo hard hit by the bushfires.
Any animal can go through a stressful event. It's staying at that heightened stress level for long periods of time that is the most damaging. As soon as we could get them back to routines, the better.
But first today, the royal family has apparently been blindsided by the decision of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle to step back from their official duties. The couple put out a statement on Instagram earlier today, saying they'd made a decision to spend less time in the UK, work towards becoming financially independent, and have a very different relationship with the media. The announcement has left commentators and the British public wondering just how this new arrangement will work. Julia Holman reports.
The Duke and Duchess of Sussex announced they're stepping back as senior royals in an unprecedented move.
It's the news no one saw coming.
Major news shaking up both sides of the pond. Prince Harry and Duchess Meghan say they'll split time between the UK and North America.
The couple say while they plan to spend a lot less time on royal duties and will work to become financially independent, they still fully intend to support the Queen. Although, according to observers, it appears they didn't share their big news with anyone in the royal family before they put out their statement.
The BBC understands Buckingham Palace is disappointed. There is hurt at the most senior levels of the family.
So far, the only response from Buckingham Palace has been a two-line statement.
Discussions with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex are at an early stage. We understand their desire to take a different approach, but these are complicated issues that will take time to work through.
Royal biographer Angela Levin says it's clear the palace was very much caught by surprise.
It's a statement of someone who has been sort of bowled over by an unexpected announcement.
And Peter Hunt, the BBC's former royal correspondent, says the contrite statement suggests the Duke and Duchess of Sussex have embarrassed and infuriated the Queen.
This was a very severe rap across the knuckles of a grandson by a grandmother. I mean, she will have been furious.
Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have also set out new rules for how they'll deal with the media. Instead of the established royal press pack that followed their every official move, a system that's been in place for more than 40 years, they say they wish to work with young, up-and-coming journalists and specialist publications in the future. The couple has had a fractious relationship with the British press. Both are pursuing legal actions against newspapers, and Prince Harry last year released a statement denouncing the media's bullying of his wife, which he likened to the treatment of his mother, Princess Diana.
I think it's a sorry state of events, really.
The Daily Mirror's royal editor, Russell Myers, is taken aback by the Duke and Duchess's attitude towards the media.
You know, the British media has been particularly supportive to Meghan when she came onto the scene. We've supported her engagement, her patronages. Also, you know, let's not forget that Prince Harry's Invictus Games was hugely supported by the British media.
And there are questions over what they mean when they say they'll work to become financially independent. Royal commentator Richard Fitzwilliam says Britons are very aware of the millions of pounds they've already spent to put up the royal couple.
The British taxpayer will remember that they paid in the last financial year £4.2 million so that Harry and Meghan could move into Frogmore Cottage. The facts of the matter are that taxpayers will not want to fund this any further, but the matter of security has to be kept in mind. Clearly, this will be extremely expensive because it will extend to North America.
And he says the couple's move will not silence those critics who feel they've taken their privileged position for granted.
To handle things in the way that they are and not take any advice, which is what they apparently are not doing, is grossly irresponsible for any royal or indeed anyone in public life.
Royal commentator Richard Fitzwilliam ending that report from Julia Holman. Professor David Flint is the national convener of Australians for Constitutional Monarchy. I asked him what he makes of the announcement from the Duke and Duchess of Sussex.
Well, I wasn't as surprised as so many royal watchers, professional royal watchers are. To me, it seems evolutionary.
But isn't it significant, though, that the son of the future king is stepping back from royal duties?
The son of the future king, yes. It is, but they are essentially royal duties. What he is doing are those various functions which are not related to representing directly the Queen, continue that. So he'll still be there, it's just that he'll be doing more of the different things he's been doing and doing them both in Britain and in North America.
What do you make, though, of the announcement from Buckingham Palace? It says discussions are still at an early stage and these are complicated issues that will take time to work through. Has the palace been taken by surprise?
I don't think so. I think the officials are trying to put a bit of a gloss on it that there are some complications. I can't see any complications.
Mr. Flint, how much of Prince Harry's decision do you think stems from what he saw his mother go through in terms of being in the public spotlight?
There is no doubt that that has a major impact on him. He was a very young boy at the time, and they blame the British media, the tabloid media, for what happened to their mother. Now, obviously, that's left its mark on them, and there's no love lost between Harry and the British media.
Some commentators have said this morning that by making this announcement, Harry and Meghan are saying the royal family isn't relevant in the 21st century. How do you respond to that suggestion?
Well, if the royal family isn't relevant, why was it struggling with the president's major announcement to head the news this morning? There we had the president making an announcement about what was happening in the Middle East with Iran. And there we had the statement from Harry and Meghan, and they were both trying to top from the point of view of the media, particularly the breakfast media, you'd think that the most important thing in the world was the fact that Harry and Meghan are going to spend more time in North America and more time on their charities.
David Flint, the National Convener of Australians for Constitutional Monarchy. In Brisbane, our reporter Rachel Mealy has been gauging the reaction to the news from London, including from some British tourists.
I think Meghan's probably too mature to want to step into it. I think she probably worked out very quickly, seeing how the family operated, and worked out that it wasn't going to help them as a family or as a couple.
To some degree, at least for me, I'm glad that they're able to discreetly thumb their nose at the tabloid media.
Yeah. As an English person, I think they're never going to be Will and Kate, and I blame Meghan.
Why? Why? Oh, what friend do you like?
That's an awful thing to say. That's a horrible thing to say. I can't believe you just said that. I'm not. I
think if William had met Meghan, they wouldn't have ever got married.
What, because she was married before?
No, just because she's too, like...
What, normal?
She's not normal, is she?
Oh,
Kate's normal.
If they want to, fair enough. Yeah, makes their life easier.
Do you think that when you're born into the royal family, there's a responsibility to stay there?
Oh, there probably is, but like the king a few years ago... Oh, more than a few years ago, but he abducted for love, didn't he? Whatever you call it.
Yeah, abdicated.
Abdicated, that's the word, for love. Yeah, if it's not happy, there's no point being in there.
And my only feeling is that if they are going to go independent and finance themselves, they can't expect us, the taxpayer, to pay for all their keep. They can't have it both ways.
A British visitor on the streets of South Brisbane talking to our reporter, Rachel Mealy. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Victorian government has extended the state of disaster declaration across East Gippsland, the Alpine region and the state's northeast as authorities prepare for an increased fire risk tomorrow. The initial declaration for those areas was to last only a week. Firefighters are working on containment lines and backburning before a gusty change starts moving through the state later today. And people in areas that could come under threat are being told to leave now. Tim Skelton reports.
Victoria's had a reprieve from severe fire conditions for the past few days, but the Premier, Daniel Andrews, says the lull ends tonight.
We have forecast conditions of extreme danger. Very significant fire activity is likely.
Some 70,000 people in fire-affected regions have heeded the advice to evacuate, and the Premier says fresh warnings will start going out today.
Ultimately, if you are given an instruction, if you are given advice, I urge you to follow it. The advice is issued for your best interests, for your safety, and indeed the safety of those who may be called to your aid.
Week-long state of disaster declarations have been extended for East Gippsland, the Alpine region and the state's northwest. The declaration gives the government the power to take possession of private property, control movement in and out of the disaster area, and direct any of its agencies to perform or stop performing any function, power, duty or responsibility. There are close to 24 fires burning across the state. The most serious right now is the Abiyar fire, burning west of Mount Buffalo, which has been spotting to the north and went to emergency warning level last night. State Emergency Commissioner Andrew Crisp says it demonstrates how volatile conditions are.
This indicates that we've still got a very active fire situation in Victoria, and particularly in the east of our state.
There are 15 relief centres open for fire-affected communities where those who've lost everything can access support. Charities and volunteers are providing food, clothing and other services. Among them is Con Karapanayiotidis, who's gone to Bairnsdale, where he's volunteering as head chef for a relief centre. He says the community response has been incredible, but there's something missing.
The local community is incredible in the way it's rallied to support each other. And then you've got people from all across Victoria here volunteering their time. What's sadly missing is one elderly man said to me today is, all around me I see all these people volunteering their time. Where are the people from Canberra? Where are our federal political leaders actually showing up and talking to us and actually seeing what we need and listening to us?
A group of doctors and nurses from Brisbane has answered the call for help from the Mallacoota Medical Centre. Dr. James Allen is among them.
Look, I think once the call went out and we heard that the medical practice had over 200 people within the first 24 hours seeking care and attention, you know, there's a lot of complex needs and things, logistics are a lot harder in a situation like this. So, you know, pretty much we felt obliged to attend.
The federal government says it will consider a call from the Rural Doctors Association and others to establish a network of doctors accredited in emergency medicine who can be mobilised in future disasters.
Tim Skelton. As fires tore through the town of Mogo on the New South Wales south coast on New Year's Eve, many people were worried about the animals at the local zoo. Staff evacuated the smaller animals and stayed to defend the lion and tiger enclosures. And against the odds, they managed to save every single creature. Those that were evacuated are now back home, and the zoo's staff are concentrating on cleaning up and establishing a veterinary hospital to care for the native animals hurt in the disaster. Our reporter Isabel Rowe toured the zoo.
As soon as you meet Chad Staples, you can tell he's exhausted.
For all the stress that was caused in the events, the animals were pretty separated from it. We did everything that we possibly could to make it as normal for them as it was through the ordeal. So as soon as we could get them back to routines, the better.
The head zookeeper at Mogo Zoo on the New South Wales south coast has taken on the emotional and physical burden of the bushfire crisis to spare his animals. As he walks the grounds of the zoo, the amount of work to do is evident.
We've got a lot of damaged fences. The good thing is that we saved every single animal. There's no injuries, there's no sickness. For the most part, exhibits are all 100%, but there's a lot to do here. It's not going to be done quickly.
Fire came perilously close to the red panda enclosure, but they'd been moved out of harm's way earlier.
So all along this river line on the other side is all completely burnt out, so
yeah,
we were battling fires
it.
All the way along here, all day, all night, for what felt like eternity. We were still putting out fires on the site 4 days later. Here we are in front of the cheetah exhibit.
Fire also reached the back of the cheetah enclosure. The cheetahs were put into their night dens on the site while staff battled flames.
Because you can't evacuate. We had to stay here and protect them.
And were you confident or were you worried?
Both. Yeah. We knew that this was the best place that we could, that we, if we worked hard, could make this a safe place. But yeah, of course, I think everyone at different point was scared out of their wits. Yeah.
Half a dozen giraffes are roaming around a large paddock at one end of the zoo.
When you get down to this part of the park where we start talking about the larger animals on paddocks, what we were able to do was just give them complete access everywhere, and then that's how they manage themselves. Yes, when it got very serious, there was, you know, the herd would move quickly, but it, for what was going on, it was still relatively calm. So the fire was all through those tree lines. Yeah.
As he stands there, a few giraffes sidle up to zookeeper Chad Staples.
Is it possible to tell if an animal is stressed after something like that?
No, but everyone's stressed. But what the idea is that any animal can go through a stressful event. It's staying at that heightened stress level for long periods of time that is the most damaging.
You've done an amazing job here, but, you know, when you drive through town and you see the amount of landscape that's been burnt, yep, you just think, you know, there were animals in there.
Yep.
Have you found any injured animals in this region, or have people come to you?
Yeah, people are bringing them in, yeah, and I think it's going to be something that happens more and more as time passes. I think that the fire moved very quickly. It was a very hot burn. I think that we've lost an enormous amount of wildlife. Mm. But what we want to now do is start to set up a bigger vet hospital that can cater to these needs for a longer period of time, because it's going to take a long time for that bush to come back.
Yeah, so it's going to be something that it's not over when the fires are over.
Absolutely,
it's
not
going to unfold.
Yep, this will go on for a little while.
Chad Staples from the Mogo Zoo, ending Isabel Rowe's report. Back overseas now, and tensions between the United States and Iran seem to have calmed after Donald Trump announced there won't be a military response to Iran's missile strikes on American forces in Iraq. In a televised address, Mr. Trump said no Americans or Iraqis were killed in the attacks and the bases targeted suffered only minimal damage. Iran's action was in retaliation to last week's assassination of the top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani. Dr. Roger Shanahan is a research fellow at the Lowy Institute. I asked him if Donald Trump is being premature in saying Iran is standing down.
Yeah, listen, I think it's probably premature in terms of an overall response, but in terms of an overt attack like this, yeah, I think it's probably accurate in the short term. But as we all know, these things tend to play out over a much longer period than just one night.
President Trump has imposed further economic sanctions on Iran. Do you think Iran will react to that?
No, listen, I think Iran's been quite careful in its language in terms of the response to the killing of General Soleimani. They've really ring-fenced their dispute to be with the Trump administration when they announced additional steps to reduce their commitment to the nuclear agreement. They could have gone much further than they did. So I think, on the one hand, they're still trying to maintain relations with the broader international community, but focusing their activities against the United States.
Do you think the attacks were an attempt to be seen to be taking action rather than to be escalating the tensions between the two?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the vision of the missile launches was on social media and mainstream media in Iran very quickly after it occurred. And so there was a significant element of domestic messaging in this response. So, yeah, certainly the domestic audience was one of the targets for this response.
How confident are you that President Trump is in fact looking to calm the situation?
Well, it's always very difficult to tell. I think in the short term, yes, he's taken up the signals that the Iranian government has given him that they believe the overt response period is over and they won't respond further in that manner if the US doesn't. And so he's sent his own signal that for the moment things are not going to escalate from here. The problem is, of course, as we see time and time again with President Trump's foreign policy actions. He does a series of random tactical actions and responses, but not tied into an overall strategic aim of how he wants the region, in this case the Middle East, to look, or the US's place within that region. So while he may say that it's over, it's very difficult because he's such an unusual character in terms of his decision-making processes.
On the Ukrainian plane that went down yesterday in Tehran, killing all 176 people on board, what do you make of the speculation that the plane was accidentally downed?
Certainly, we have to be very careful about what we take away from social media. You know, the timing is obviously very, very, on the one hand, suspicious, but we know that coincidences do occur.
The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has said he's going to send investigators to survey the site. Do you think those Canadian investigators will run into diplomatic hurdles?
Listen, you would think on the face of it, it's going to be difficult to get Canadian investigators onto that site. And not impossible, but Canadian relations with Iran are not good. There's currently no Canadian embassy operating in Iran. Diplomatic relations are not good. And then there's the obvious sensitivities of the Iranians allowing another country in to do an investigation. You never say never, but this would be a very difficult thing to pull off.
Dr. Roger Shanahan, a research fellow at the Lowy Institute. The fugitive ex-boss of car giant Nissan has taken a swipe at Japan's justice system after a daring escape from the country. Carlos Ghosn faces charges relating to financial crimes in Japan. And in his first public appearance since fleeing, he's described his detention conditions there as a travesty of human rights. Thomas Ariti has this report.
His escape has perplexed Japanese authorities, and now Carlos Ghosn has appeared in public in Lebanon, a country where he's regarded by many as a hero.
I did not escape justice. I fled injustice and persecution.
He didn't hold back. Accompanied by his wife, the former titan of Japan's auto industry was scathing of the country's justice system, saying he was arrested as part of a plot linked to a decline in the financial performance of Nissan. He favoured merging Nissan with industry ally Renault, of which he was also chairman, but says some in the industry disagreed.
I'm here to clear my name and to pronounce clearly and emphatically something that was interpreted as a heresy in the Japanese judicial system. These allegations are untrue, and I should have never been arrested in the first place.
But he was. Back in 2018, Tokyo prosecutors alleged he'd underreported his income for several years, and they questioned his use of company assets. The man who saved Nissan from near collapse almost two decades ago was suddenly under strict surveillance awaiting trial. Now he's an international fugitive, fleeing to Lebanon, where he grew up.
I was facing a system where the conviction rate is 99.4%. And I will bet you that this number is much higher for the foreigners.
There's still a lot of speculation about how Carlos Ghosn managed to escape. According to media reports, he slipped out of Japan on a private jet hidden in a large black case, typically used to carry audio gear. Regardless of the details, it's an embarrassment to law enforcement agencies in Japan, where he was supposedly under rigorous surveillance. And he wouldn't be drawn on how he did it.
I'm not here to talk about how I managed to leave Japan. I'm here to talk about why I left. For the first time since this nightmare began, I can defend myself.
The Japanese government has been quick to respond. Justice Minister Masako Mori.
He has been propagating, both within Japan and internationally, false information on Japan's legal system and its practice. This is absolutely intolerable. Japan's criminal justice system sets out appropriate procedures and is administered properly to clarify the truth in cases while guaranteeing basic individual human rights.
Unions say they still want to see Carlos Ghosn face the courts. Jean-François Pibelot is a union representative for Renault.
He mustn't have preferential treatment with the justice systems he must answer to. But the first people he must answer to are the Renault workers. He's accused of having embezzled money from companies. And if it's true, the Renault workers consider that what he may have done is unacceptable.
Japanese justice officials say it's unclear whether Carlos Ghosn can be brought back to Japan to face the charges.
Thomas Arete, and that's The World Today for this Thursday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.